chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
If you're drowning and I throw you a life jacket, would you grab it? Yes, good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns?
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know this.
That's it. I'm done.
Welcome to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Alley, Mr. Matt Weber. S&P futures up 50 cents, NASDAQ futures up 75 cents, Dow futures up 23. So not much going on this morning. Obviously an interesting week as we have two counts of impeachment, against the president, and he's squealing like a stuck pig about the whole thing. So much for the quiet defense. The thing now goes to the Senate, which to be determined, scheduled to be determined, seems to be just about everything. It's not a good day if something like that happens. I, for one, personally think it's not a very good idea. I think there's a lot better way to go about it, but they're not asking me. Hey, Carl, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing good.
I was just saying they're not asking me about impeachment. They're not asking me about anything, so that's where all that is. They ask
me. Well, you know, this thing that they're doing right now, I don't even know that this qualifies as impeachment by the rules that impeachment is supposed to follow. You know, now Pelosi has said she's going to try to hold on to the articles that were passed last night as a means of extracting leverage and how the proceeding takes place. And she ought to take a read of the Constitution. She did. She's not in control of it anymore. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, I don't get it. I don't put the part with the speaker or whatever, the head of the Senate working right and left with the attorneys of the White House. They're supposed to be trying the guy, not working with
well,
him.
Well, now, wait a minute. See, this is where Mitch is right, though. And this is the same thing that happened with Clinton, is that, you know, when Clinton was impeached, the thing that a lot of people fail to remember is that the two sides essentially brokered what they were going to do. Okay. Which included, by the way, calling no witnesses. All
right. Right.
And then what even got more outrageous was that, you know, there was a huge documentary record because of the Ken Starr investigation. All right. Not one senator went over to the skiff in the House and read those documents. Not one.
Well, I mean, we don't have a whole hell of a lot of, shall we say, Andrew Johnson was like a long time ago, and then we had Clinton. So to,
right.
so to go back and say this is the way things ought to be done is a little bit bizarre.
That's the point, I think, is that, you know, people are like, well, you know, there's some kind of a, you know, there's some sort of a, you know, requirement that the Senate do this, you know, some group of ways that, you know, the people in the House like.
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that.
That's just not how it works.
I'm just looking at it as the way that anybody would have a modicum of common sense. I mean, when do you bring in the Chief Justice? After somebody else makes all the rules? I mean, he's supposed to be...
Well, actually, yes, and that's the funny thing about this, is that the Chief Justice, he presides over the hearing, okay? However, there's also history on that. During Clinton's impeachment, the Republicans wanted the Chief Justice, who at the time was Rehnquist, to essentially issue a jury charge to them, because the senators are the jurors, and say, you must follow the evidence, you must go where it leads, you know, you must judge these proceedings on the, you know, on the basis of fairness and what the evidence shows. And Rehnquist refused to do it. He in fact turned around and said, no, that's not how it works. And what he told the Senate was, this is an impeachment proceeding. You are free to use whatever criteria you wish to judge this, including a completely partisan political process.
Which is interesting.
Which is exactly what they did, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, they didn't hear any, you know, they didn't hear any testimony other than the, you know, the House presenting, you know, the House managers presenting their, you know, their articles. So, it's this, there are a lot of people who have this idea that, number one, the House couldn't do this, that they, you know, they couldn't impeach on the basis of whatever. Yes, they can. However, the problem that the House now has is that there is plenty of documentary evidence in the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist that says that the founders explicitly tried to prevent impeachment from using being used as a no-confidence motion, essentially, okay? Because they have plenty of evidence, you know, plenty of experience and evidence with that, parliamentary systems around the world, where you could essentially toss out a prime minister anytime you, you know, you get enough people don't like him, right?
Well, yeah.
And, well, and that's, I mean, that's how parliamentary systems work around the world and always have. And the founders rejected, they actually required that, you know, they put the language in high crime, you know, the bribery, treason, high crimes and other misdemeanors. And it's high misdemeanors. High modifies both crimes and misdemeanors. So there is supposed to be some evidence of wrongdoing that were he not president, you could charge him. Now, the biggest issue that you have with what they reported out is that not only did they not have a crime of any kind, but obstruction of Congress, whether you like it or not, is not a thing. Now, obstruction of justice is a thing, but that somebody says, you know, hey, I got a subpoena, bite me, I'm going to court to try to block it, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that in American jurisprudence. Now, once that gets heard all the way up the line through the courts, and the Supreme Court, which is, you know, where it ultimately ends up, says, no, sorry, you got to comply, now it's obstruction of justice if you don't turn it over. If you remember, with Nixon, he managed to hold out right up until the point at which the Supreme Court said, you have to turn over what Congress wants. And at that point, he gave up because he'd lost his support.
Well,
he knew now there was actually something he'd be convicted on, and at that point he resigned. But the other thing is that when Obama was in office, the House attempted to go after the Fast and Furious documentation from Eric Holder.
Right.
And Eric Holder told them to pound sand, that it was protected by executive privilege. They went to court, and he ran the clock on them. And they knew they couldn't impeach Obama for that until they got a final judgment back from the Supremes, and it just never happened because he wasn't the Attorney General anymore.
Yeah, like I said, I'm not... I think absolutely deserved from this guy is pick his 10 most egregious things, be calling American scumbags, being calling Congress people losers and all the other stuff, and just say this is whatever you want to call that, an item of censure, just list the 10 and say this is not the way a president acts, shape up. I'd be all for that. I don't think this is the right way. I've been on record on that for a long time. I don't think they have. He has an awful lot of, I'll say, misdemeanors along the way. I don't know if he's got a felony. And like you, I agree that you need a felony to get tossed. The equivalent of one.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't see, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't like a lot of stuff that's been going on, okay? I mean, one of the,
we lost you for more than a second.
I think we lost Carl. I'll call him back.
Yeah, we'll get him. And to the extent that we have to live with this now for seemingly months, we don't. To me, those are self. This is all self-inflicted wounds. I mean, we don't need to be doing this. I just, you know, I think it's going to affect. Carl, are you back?
Yep, I am.
I was going to say, I think this goes into my category. This goes into like a self-inflicted wound. We don't need to be doing this for 4 months, but I do think that at some point, somebody in Congress has to tell this guy very, very publicly, this isn't the way you behave. And it's not the kind of...
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that I understand where his activities and the way that he looks at things comes from, because his, you know, his business background is basically pounding people over the head in New York, and that's just kind of sort of the way that being a commercial real estate developer works in New York City, right? I mean, you don't have to like it, but it is what it is. On the other hand, that's not a president, okay? I mean, it's two different things. But, if you ask me, for the two or three things that I think you ought to be tossed out of office for, not addressing the budgetary and specifically medically related scams is the biggest one, and then essentially going along with the fiscal destruction of the country. I mean, look at what they just did with the budget that just got passed.
Oh yeah, it's unreal.
Okay, it's criminal. Okay, and at some point, the people in this country, everyone always says, well, we're leaving this to our kids and our grandkids and blah 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 blah. Well, guess what, guys? They're not going to pay.
Right.
Okay. And at some point, they're going to stand up and they're going to say, you can go blank yourself. And at that point, there's a problem, because what do you do when the bond market starts to throw up on this? Oh, by the way, for Jerome Powell's supposed reticence and supposed independence, when the bond market threw up on this a couple of months ago, what did he do? He threw $300 billion into the system.
Did they waterboard him when he went to the White House that night?
Well, I think they did, and
or paddle him or something.
You got to wonder what else they did to the guy. I mean, what, have they got a picture of him doing a goat?
I mean, something is. I don't understand. I guess the more I do the show, and the more I learn from the people on the show, certainly you included, maybe you leading the pack. You know what I found the other day? This will floor you. Talk about a blind squirrel finding an acorn. I found a Business Insider article from 10 years ago, studying the German stock market during hyperinflation.
Yeah.
Went straight up. The Germans thought this was cool. They went from 20...
Of course it did. But, again, everyone thinks it's so, there's no inflation. I wrote an article on this the other day. Just look at the Skyway.
Yeah.
Okay? What if you live on the wrong end of that thing and you got to get to work?
Right.
What does that do to you if you're working a $10 an hour job? Okay, what does that do to you? You got to cross it both directions. What is the effective tax rate that the state stuffed down your throat on top of everything else you have to pay?
It's an eighth of your salary.
Yeah.
A little more.
I mean, excuse me? By the way, you want to talk about regressive taxes.
Yeah.
The less you make, the worse it hurts.
Well, I guess what I'm not going to accuse, because as the weeks go on, Carl, and people send me stuff, and you guys come in, and I learn more. I mean, I know a hell of a lot more than I did 2 years ago, and more then than the 2 years before. It bothers me, and I don't know. I wonder if it's a psychological question, a sociological question, what it is. I listened to the head of the Richmond Fed yesterday. Carl, the man is I'm sure he is. He's got way more degrees than I do. I'm sure he's a lot brighter. The man sounds like a moron. I mean, an absolute moron. When he talked about how fantastic a job they're doing, because last year the rise in wages was 3% and the rise in inflation was 1.6, so everybody gained 1.4%. Does he even come close to look at the numbers and believe that? How can he?
Well, their job is to lie, okay? I mean, the infamous quote that has been attributed to both Draghi and Lagarde is when things are really serious, you have to lie convincingly.
Well, Hitler was big on that.
Well, going to say, when I first heard that it's been attributed to both of them, my initial reaction was, sounds an awful lot like something that a certain Adolf said a few times.
he blamed that. He said he learned that from. You know this.
Yeah, I just don't understand.
He said he learned it from the Jews.
The people in this country that just sit and laugh this stuff up.
Well, I got more of a specific question regarding it. I've been really doing a deep dive since the weather's been so lousy on Saturdays. I've been taking a couple hours out in the center and just doing research by myself. How scary is that? And I don't know what the mathematical term is, Carl. Maybe you do, but when things have been, shall we say, misreported for so long, or there's been such a miscast for so long. I'm talking about wages versus some of the expenses in the last 20 years. You can get to the point where one of them is so far behind the rest that you can't talk in percentage terms anymore. They don't make any sense. And I think we're sort of there. I mean, if you talk about a wage that went from, pick a number, $33,000 a year, I'll even be generous and say to $38,000 or even $40,000, which it didn't in 20 years, where the wages are up, I'm going to say 15%. The inflation that they say is what's there is up 52%. That's if you look at the CPI. And if you look at the stuff that isn't there, like college education and hospitalization stuff, which is up pushing 300%, when you get to the point where you say, it's been a great year, Mr. Denninger, what's the matter with you? Inflation or hospitalization is up 5% and your wage is up 6%, you gained on it. No, you didn't, because the wages have been so low for so long. It's like GE going from 100 to 5 and now it goes to 550. What are you talking about, Carl? It's up 10%. I mean, it's up 50 cents. You know, I mean, we're to the point where the numbers, if you use them in percentage terms, don't even matter now, I think. This is the result of my research. I think I should have gone to the saloon instead or what?
Yeah, no, you're right. And I mean, it's, you know, the thing that really gets me is that when you go back and you look at this and where this all started, it's gone on for so long.
Yes. Okay. That's my point.
It goes all the way back to the destruction of the ability of a family of four to have one person go out and earn a wage and have everybody else be reasonably okay in a modest bungalow that, you know, has three bedrooms and, you know, a couple baths.
Right? You know, they were fed. They might have the station wagon with the three on the tree, but they had a car, had a house, and were good to go.
Yeah, and, you know, and the lights were on, and, you know, I mean, yeah, okay, yeah. Your telephone was on a wall, and there was no such thing as the internet. You also didn't have a $200, bill for television. You had a pair of rabbit ears on top.
Right. Well, my $190 bill for television and computer, I don't necessarily, I think that's too high. But then $61 of it is taxes. How the hell did the city weasel in for a third of that bill?
Well, that's part of the problem, though. It's like, you know, people look at this and say, well, you know, it's not all that big a deal. Well, excuse me, what do you do when you're in a place that there is no competition? Right? I mean, what do you do when the city turns around and, you know, jacks your property taxes or jacks your garbage service or, you know, or whatever, right? I mean, it's not like you can turn around and say, oh, I'm not going to pay.
No. Well, you can leave, which people are doing. Well, you can leave.
So, I mean, I just don't get where they think this is. How do you get these numbers that they report? Say, oh, you know, everything's all wonderful. Well, not really.
Well, when you look at just in this area, you haven't been here in a while, I don't think. Sure, if you did, you didn't call us, take us out for dinner or anything, but or have us buy you a drink. We've had such amazing development, like on the west side. And we're talking about, the McDonald's moves into Google. I mean, this is massive growth. I mean, this is good stuff. I mean, nobody can say anything bad about it. If you and I had a corner over there and we got a bar in that area, well, you know, we can on a Friday night. Not only is the scenery like something you never saw, Carl, but every young person is in these bars along Lake Street. And, it's a beautiful thing. Now, in my area in the South Loop, where we've lost the exchanges, really, we really have long the SIBO is moving to the post office building, which is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, but that's another story from another day. But the buildings here, the amount of vacancies and the one across the street are just dramatic. There was a CVS in there. Now, I'm not supposed to know these numbers. I think, Carl, they're paying $17.5 rent for the last, I guess, I bet they've been there 15 years, maybe at least. I mean,
yeah, probably.
And but they signed one of those leases. What are the leases? You and John Flanagan know this stuff. What's the lease where every increase in taxes and in other kinds of maintenance and other kinds of BS that the city throws at you is a full flow through? Where if the taxes go up, you know, 10%, whatever square footage piece you have, you got to pay that part of the 10% in addition to your rent.
Right. Most of the time they're triple net. So the tax operating expenses just flow through to the tenant.
Well, these guys got to the point where they're okay with the 17.5. The tax flow through after whatever it was, 15, 20 years, is now $240 a year. So it's another $20,000 a month. It's more than the rent.
Yeah.
And they said, we're not doing this. We're not paying $37 a month. What are you guys doing? And they're going, it's not us, it's the city. Well, too bad. See ya. You know, I mean, the building we're in, which is not a type A building, rumor has it, They're up from, in the last 15 years, they're up from 80 grand to 240 in taxes.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, that's the thing is that United States and Prudential and True Pru, okay, and we had a very nice deal on the space in terms of, you know, the gross rent. And, but we were in there before this insanity started with, you know, with the property tax ramps. And of course, you know, our lease was triple net like every other commercial lease is. And so good God. I mean, if I had been there for, you know, the last 20 years, there's no way I would have been able to stay there. I would have ended up somewhere, I would have moved the company. We wouldn't have stayed in the city. No way.
But you, as you, I'm saying as somebody looking at it from an economic point, there's always this poor stuff in the top, good-looking people coming in working for Google. All the women are 28 and good-looking, and the guys are 30 and good-looking and whatever. And you got all this stuff pouring in there, and it's a big boon. And yet you got all these holes, holes in the ship, all the other places. I don't know if you're gaining on it or you're not.
Well, you know, I just put an article up this morning. It's funny that the conversation went this way because I didn't know it was going to, of course. It's Shapiro running around screaming about how the Supreme Court just hosed all of the West Coast cities that have this homeless issue. And I, you know, Mr. Limousine Liberal out of New York, right? And what I pointed out to him is that, excuse me, you guys created this problem. You took a city where you could actually live on a middle-class income, destroyed that. I made that impossible because you've got all these Silicon Valley millionaires. They're out of, you know, they're out of everywhere. You essentially turn the housing stock into something nobody can possibly live in if you don't make 250 grand a year. What do you do with the guy that pulls your coffee at Starbucks?
Yeah, where does he go?
Where does he go? And the thing is, and then the problem is, you refused to sweep your own floors in your office buildings. You refuse to wait your own tables. You insist on being able to go out into these bars and get drinks, and, you know, even if they are $10 a piece. The fact of the matter is that what do you do when you force these people out of their jobs? Well, what they could do is decide to walk into one of those buildings, grab a random person, drag them out by their hair, and barbecue them in the middle of the street. But instead of doing something very antisocial and illegal, they decide to destroy themselves by getting drunk or stoned all day. And now you want to throw them in jail after you ruined their ability to actually get ahead and have a decent life?
Yeah, it's I had a situation. Well, whatever, I ended up meeting one of the homeless people here when we first came down here. How can I say this politically correctly? In the 80s, there were a bunch of older guys, you know, most of them were African-American, but not all. I'd say half and half, a little bit more than half and half. And every building had, like, wherever you walked to the trading floor from, you kind of had your bum, for lack of a better term, right? And these are guys that lived in the Mission at night, and they came by and, you know, did their stuff during the day. And it wasn't, these guys were, you know, I don't know what the term would be, but they're older, they're something. Now, these people are in their 30s. There's couples out here that are living underneath these streets. And most of the, there's a guy last week I ran into when I started talking to him. Guy's name's Dan, like my brother. And he says, I used to work for this pallet maker, and the place all of a sudden was gone one day. And I said, well, what's the deal here? And he goes, well, I mean, you can tell by talking to him, he's a little bit, not 100%, but he's certainly could hold a job. And he did for quite a while. And I said, well, what's the deal? He goes, if we can make $21, that's the number over here that you can get a place where you can get a bed. I said, if not, we're underneath the bridge. And I'm thinking, with all the money people that we spend with a million different programs that seemingly people got their finger in a pie and none of it makes it, why can't we just have a $2,000 a day and give 100 of these guys a room? I mean, without anybody in the middle, just walk over there with $20 bills and hand them out. I mean, without anybody in the middle getting their 15% there and 20% or a program through this preacher or that guy or this guy or this. I mean, we can't get anywhere, Carl. Let's save it to after Braven. But the whole Tricky Dick was maybe okay with his negative income tax. SP Futures up 75 cents. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox. The Control Freak's Guide to Life, Money, and Probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. He's Mr. Matt Weber. He is Mr. Carl Denninger. Stocks rally through impeachment as presses. Investors bet on a Clinton-like income. Outcome, what's the difference? S&P futures up 25 cents. NASDAQ futures up $1.50. Actually, the December's are up $1.50. The Marches are down 75 cents. As we should go from top step to bottom step. I should probably trade the Marches. I should be giving that number out. We have the Dow up 28 points. Individual stocks in the Dow. We got Boeing up $2. Boeing's rallied about $12 off its low the other day, Carl. I'm not exactly sure where that's coming from, other than the fact that Monopoly does have privileges. We have Micron up $2 on their earnings last night. Boy, Federal Express had a crummy day yesterday. It's only bouncing back 29 cents today. It was down $16 yesterday, and they had pretty much a horrible day. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 41.3%, FTSE up 20.3%, CAC around down 3, call that flat. So very mixed over there. Asia, Nikkei down 69.2%, Shanghai up 2 cents. I'm going to have to call that one flat. Hang Seng down 83, that's 0.3%. Bonds, Japan, here we go again, minus 0.01. Will we make it? Bund, minus 0.21. So they're marching toward. They got down to minus 0.79. So they're really well on their way back to zero. And get a load of this, 10-year 1.94. You can fool all the people all the time, Maddie. You can fool all the people some of the time, some of the people all the time, and you can't fool all the people all the time. Is that how that goes? Maybe people are actually saying, maybe I'm not going to give money to the government at 1.7% for 10 years. I want a little more. I hope they all wake up and think that way. Oil up 5 cents, 60.98. Brent up 2 cents. Not much going on there. Natural gas, 224, down 4 cents. We're going to get Carl's opinion as to whether it goes below $2 this summer. RBOB gas, 168. And last but not least, gold down 39 cents, 14.78. Silver right on the number, $17, down 4 cents. Maddie, we got it for us, traffic, weather, sports.
38 minutes past the hour. Good morning to everyone out there. For the first time all week, Chief, we're off to a good start in the traffic department. No issues coming in on the Edens. Traffic building on the Kennedy, but no accidents to report. Yesterday morning, we had 5 or 6 accidents on the Kennedy throughout the morning.
Well, we saw two of them.
Yeah, and we saw a couple. Traffic building on the Eisenhower, but looking pretty good. Stevenson, nice and quiet. Dan Ryan, I-57 and the Bishop Ford are looking good, too. Suburban tollways are all quiet. The only issue in the area right now is in the western suburbs. Butterfield Road at Route 53, there is a crash that's causing a bit of a slowdown. But everything else looking good out there. Weather today, very cold early, but then we'll warm up this afternoon, so that'll feel nice. Right now, it's 19 degrees with a wind chill of about 7 above zero, but we're going up to a sunny high of 39 today, which will feel like we're in the 60s compared to the last couple of days, so that's looking forward to that. In Phoenix, sunshine with a high of 64 today. Right now it's partly cloudy and 39. In sports, the Bulls were down 18 in the fourth quarter and rallied back to beat Washington 110-109 in overtime. Blackhawks were blown out by the Avalanche at home 4-1. Hawks have lost 11 of their last 15, including 5 of their last 6.
They're getting worse.
Busy night in college basketball. DePaul is now 11-1 on the season. They won at Cleveland State 73-65. Northwestern played Michigan State tough up in Evanston last night, but fell to the 15th-ranked Spartans 77-72. Loyola with a nice win over SEC's Vanderbilt in Nashville 78-70 for the Loyola Ramblers. And Arizona State is not having a great year. They lost by 40 to St. Mary's 96-56.
Why are they so lousy when Arizona's so good, like every year?
I don't know. They brought in Bobby Hurley, the legendary Duke player and then the coach, and he brought them to the tournament, I think, 1 year of his first 3 or 4 years, and now they seem to be trending in the wrong direction. They got smoked last night.
Carl, I guess, you know, we talk about a million subjects. We were just talking about the homeless people. And you know what? It comes back to being the same subject. Why do people not see this stuff? Why do they lie about it? And why do they not do anything? And what is the motivation for the Richmond Fed guy, I'll use a Nazi term, to just spout the party line? Is there some sort of a veil these people take that only they know the right thing and it's their job to keep the rest of us in the dark? Or they must know the numbers are out there if anybody wants to find them. I mean, you better than me, but I don't get the motivation. What is it?
The only thing I can come up with is that they know how much trouble they're in. You know, it's kind of like the guy who, you know, he starts having a couple of vodkas after you know, he gets done with work, right? And after a few years, he's drinking a whole bottle.
Yep.
And well, if you keep doing that, you're going to die. Okay, I mean, that's, you know, how that's going to end is not really in question. So, but the problem is, if you stop, it's really going to hurt.
Yep.
For a while. All right, it's going to hurt bad. And so, you know, I think the Fed, to a large degree, you know, they've got into this box. They did this they've been doing it for a long time, but it really took off after 2008 because we didn't throw anybody in jail for any of the things that they did. You contrast that with the SNL thing. When the SNL thing blew up, there were like 1,500 people that went to prison. I mean, they indicted people left and right for the frauds that were involved in all of those crazy.
Carl, it's a lot easier.
And a lot of those people went to jail.
It's a lot easier to throw somebody in jail from, which didn't happen, by the way, from Evergreen Park Savings and Loan than it is from Citigroup.
Well, yeah, I know. I'm just saying, you know, but people did go to prison, and now the thing is, he actually had an official opinion by the Attorney General when Holder was AG that said, well, we can't indict major corporations, we can't indict the officers, because look what happened when we did it to Arthur Anderson. Okay, and so after Arthur Anderson, the DOJ just won't do it. And so you have every scam in the world that gets run, and the same thing's going on in the medical system. What these people do with the medical billing, if I tried to do something like that and was running my internet company, I'd still be rotting in prison for violating antitrust law. And so it's, you know, the idea that you could just do this kind of thing, but then you get the Fed that backs it up, okay, and they start swallowing up all of the credit emission that comes from this, because what are you going to do? You run a $1 trillion deficit. Somebody's got to suck that up. If you don't have the Fed doing it, what happens to interest rates?
Well, Carl, why can't we, I mean, in terms of crime and punishment, and I did a course on this at the University of Chicago, of all places. When it comes to a corporation, I mean, the idea with a Arthur Anderson, and they screwed up there because you've got a name of a corporation and you've got an accounting firm. There was a law in the book somewhere that said if an accounting firm had a felony, that they couldn't do audits, right, or something weird like that. Wasn't that the story?
Well, same thing's true for banks, though. By the way,
okay, but what I'm saying is, that doesn't stop me, if I'm Eric Holder, from, if I think that all these people on this particular board or whatever, or it was like the Sun-Times board with big Jim Thompson was on it, or the Enron board with Wendy Graham, you know, Phil Graham's wife on it, or where was Elena Cho? What board was she on? The bank, Wells Fargo.
Yeah,
I mean, what is stopping you from saying the fine is not for the shareholders, the fine is for the executives that got the bonuses in the last few years, and oh, by the way, everybody who's on the board is going to be forced to resign and be banned from being a board member in a major corporation for the rest of their life. And by the way, it's $50,000 a pop for those people too. Even if it doesn't matter if it's $25 or $50,000 or a million, it would set the message straight. You get some new board members, you get some new executives, get these people the hell out of here. You don't pin it on the shareholders where they pay the fine and you get a bonus. There's ways to do this, Carl, that if we think about it for a second, we can do, to where if you and I own the place, we're not, there's this whole idea, it's like, it's almost like in warfare, okay? Before we talk about going off field, we firebombed Dresden, right? Why? The war was already won. Did we think the people from Dresden were going to somehow march their way to Hitler's bunker and kill the guy? Or have any kind of power to do anything that we wanted them to do? It's sort of like, you know, we're going to fine the shareholders $1 billion. And yet the SEC will resist, like if it's their money, anybody coming, the shareholders electing anybody from the outside that the board doesn't pick. How can those two things work together? We're gonna fine the shareholders with this ignorant idea that somehow they should change their leadership. Then if they try and change their leadership, the SEC is the one who fights them. I mean,
it's lunacy. But you know, I think at the end of the day, what it comes down to is that you have this thing, and this goes back to the speech you were talking about yesterday. Okay, he's kind of doing the blubbering baby thing. What the Fed does not want to say is what the Fed has done, which is that we no longer have an economy that is predicated in job market and everything else is predicated on guys building cars or, you know, wiring buildings or whatever have you. The entire thing is predicated on asset prices have to keep going up because people are taking that and using that as an extraction mechanism. And look at what they've done by destroying the bond market and the coupon that you can get off of bonds. They forced the pension systems into the stock market.
Right.
So if you have a crash now, and there will be one someday, I mean, people say, oh, it's never going to happen again. Oh, yes, it will. But now what you're going to do is you're going to bankrupt all the pension systems.
Well, that's
and,
right.
And how they think they're going to get out of that box.
Well, that's what I...
You know?
I mean, I'm thinking from what my Fed guys tell me, that if you look at the money supply numbers like I do from the old days, it's not quite the same. I get that. I think I get that, Carl, because some of the money every night comes back to the Fed. M0 is bigger than it ever has been, which is the amount of money back on deposit in the Fed. So I'm going to say that probably a 4% money supply growth in your and my day was actually a little excessive because the economy's growing at 2.5-3. And so you wanted to sort of match one with the other, maybe a little bit higher. But clearly when you get to 8, you and I would say that's a little too friggin' high, you idiots, because all you're going to do is pump inflation in. But then again, if you ignore where the inflation is, that's fine, okay? But the story is they're not – instead of saying we got away with it at 8, let's maybe do that for another year or two if we can. And so let's – but now they're at 10. On our way to 11, are they going to push this to the edge? Are they going to absolutely find the edge of the cliff by their own? Why not say we're getting away with 8? Let's leave it at 8. That's good enough. Why do they have to? Or is the economy in so much such bad shape that they have to do more and more to get in the same place?
Well, that's the problem with adding debt. It's exponential series always end this way. I put this graph up. This first one in the book that I wrote, you know, Leverage After the Crash, and it's just a simple mathematical fact. Anytime you have two exponential series, compound growth numbers, where one has a higher growth percentage than the other, doesn't matter where the two start, the one with the higher growth percentage always takes over and eats the other one. Always.
Right.
There's nothing you can do about this. So you cannot have growth of debt in the system faster than growth of the economy. You cannot do it. Now, over the short term, can you do it as a counter-cyclical thing when there's a bad recession? Yeah, you could. But on a consistent basis, you cannot do this. And eventually, what ends up happening is that each dollar of additional debt that you put in the system returns less than a dollar of output because you're trying to consume more than 100% of something, which can't happen. And so, you know, this is where the system blows up, and these guys seem to think that this kind of game playing can go on forever, and yet, as I've been pointing out now for over 10 years, by 2024, we're at current growth rates, the first 2 months of the new fiscal year, we're right on track on this, we're going to try to spend $2.5 trillion on Medicare and Medicaid. It was $1.5 this last fiscal, $1.57. We're going to try to spend 2.4 by the end of the next presidential term. That isn't going to happen.
No, it can't. Well, unless they pour so much money in that the nominal money will be there.
Oh yeah, the nominal money will be there, but gas will be $10 a gallon, and property taxes will double again. How are you going to pay that?
Well, that's the issue. To me, Carl, it looks. By the way, I got a quote here for you, just to prove to you that I found this. There's a book called When Money Dies. Evidently, it's a history of the Weimar. Speculation on the stock exchange has spread to all ranks of the population, and shares rise like air balloons to limitless heights. The population is now engaged in evading taxation and devoting their money to speculative purchases. Shares and respective concerns, which had paid a 20% dividend, were pushed higher and higher till final holders cannot expect the return of even 1%. But here's my social question for you. It seems to me, just going back and reading stuff, books, maybe some with pictures, that every generation there's some kind of a war, seems like it, and the people who are involved in the war say, this was so awful, this was so blankety, this will never happen again. And you got people walking around on arms and legs and other people that don't come back. Yet, seemingly like 25 or 30 years later, there's this collective amnesia that comes across, and the younger people somehow think that this is a glorious thing, and we end up having another one, or something. It's the same thing. I would never have dreamed when I was going through the stuff at Pullman with the inflation calculations and everything, and saw the carnage that this caused. Although in those days it didn't cause carnage to savers because they actually got the money, right? Because the inflation was declared. But actually, they didn't get the money in the first 2 years, but they did near the end. Now, in my lifetime, I would have said, we will never go through this again. The pain of this is too bad. Yeah, here it is, essentially pushing 40 years later. And what's the problem? Money supply. I just pulled up a money supply chart from the early 70s, growing at 11-12%. And 3 years later, we had Armageddon when it came to the economy. Or 4 years later, I mean, and now we're poking that alligator again. Is it collective amnesia? What is it?
Well, it's you get backed into a corner. You got a president that screams about stuff like this. You have a former president who did the same thing. Okay, none of what went on got addressed. It was too painful to actually allow the economy to adjust and allow asset prices to come back down to where they needed to be. Real assets, not stocks, but, you know, houses, things, buildings, things like this.
Baseball teams.
Yeah, but, you know, here we are, and yet, you know, nobody wants to take the medicine, because now what you've done is you've shifted all of this. Everything else now is into equities, because what else are you going to do? If you're a coupon manager, you have to have the income in order to service what you're doing. You're running a pension fund or whatever have you. Where else are you going to go? With a 2% 10-year? Are you kidding me?
But Carl, if you're going to go down this road, if you actually believe that having rates very low, okay, increase production, allow somebody who maybe wouldn't start up a business if he had to pay 10% for money. If he can pay 3%, he'll start up the business and he'll create it. If you actually believe that, and I'm not saying that, I don't believe a little bit of that, okay, that if the rates are lower, that if somebody can borrow money easily, or you should have a little. But if you're, I never say this on the air, but I will this time. If you're stupid enough, if you believe that, you can't be stupid enough to not make sure that those rates get down to the people that you actually expect to build the place. You can't have, if you're going to do that, you can't get down to where, well, here's Matt Weber. He's at the age where he should be starting his own business. Wait a minute. Matt's got 15 grand on a credit card and he's paying 28%. Well, right. How's he paying 28%? Interest rates are 2%. Well, no. For everybody else, they're 28%. For five companies, they're 2%. Or for the government, they're 2%.
Right.
I mean, at least if you honestly are a believer, you have to make sure the chief and Denninger Enterprises can go into a bank and borrow money at 4%. That ain't happening.
Well, it isn't going to happen, and it's never going to happen, because it's not about, you know, what you say is it is to help the economy. The truth is that what it is to allow the federal government to run a $1 trillion deficit and not
right.
choke on the interest payments.
I'm going to say that the plumber who wants the fifth van is going to pay at a bank probably 8.5%, and now they're going to want a personal guarantee because of some stupid rule when he can't even sign for the corporation anymore. I'm going to say it's harder for him to get that loan than it was 10 years ago.
You know, you're right, but I'll tell you what, if you think that this is a new thing, when I was running MCS, C Corp, they still were trying to get personal guarantees. It was one of the reasons I never borrowed any money.
Well, it back in the day on the trading floor, if it was a partnership, the individual trader on the floor, this caught me during the crash, he had to be a general partner.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Do you know that we didn't have these issues with banks like Goldman and Citibank when all the places that were not taking retail deposits, the investment banks, they were all partnerships.
Right.
And that meant that the guys that were running the place, they were personally on the line when they screwed up.
Right.
And boy, you know, isn't it funny how they didn't screw up all that often?
But the thing of it is, now they are not personally on the line, but the plumber is.
Right. They don't get hosed
right.
when they screw up, but the plumber gets hosed.
Right.
Right, so you know what? So the plumber has to be careful, but they don't. And this means that everything is wonderful for the people that are bribing all those guys in D.C.?
Well, I mean, the whole idea that these guys are you can't get anything straight on any of these people because everybody's bribing these guys. I don't know. I mean, is the great democracy experiment just not working, Carl, or is this just a blip where we'll figure it out here? There'll be.
Oh, I don't think that. I don't see how you can figure it out, because unless the government takes on this medical issue. This is where it all centers when you look at the budgetary problems. You know, you just saw the Democrats say, well, we've got this bill that we just passed in the House that's going to, you know, that's, they've got this pie-in-the-sky number on reducing drug costs, okay, for Medicare and Medicaid. And it, okay, except that last year, Medicare's drug spend, Part D, was 5% of the total. So even if you could get rid of it, which of course you can't because you can't make the price zero, all right, you're leaving 95% of the problem alone, but you're running around screaming like your hair is on fire that you're doing something wonderful. And this is what they do all the time. They ignore the 95% of the problem. That's where you have to focus your attention, and that's where the issue has to go. But no, we can't do that because then we'd have some stock prices that would go down.
Well, that's right. And I think that if you and I, and we'll drag Kevin in with us because he's very, very detail-oriented, if we sat down, you know, I would fix it. I would make an attempt to fix it. I'd sit there and say, all right, let's assume, for instance, PTI all of a sudden buys 8 other firms and we now have, you know, 500 brokers and we got 100 locations, which I don't think I ever want, but if we did, we should be able to, Carl, when I say we, because you'd be one of the partners, hopefully, we should be able to essentially run our own medical thing here, right? Now, the things you got to watch out for are pre-babies and those kinds of things and some brain cancers and so forth. But by and large, other than a huge umbrella policy for stuff like that, we should be able, if we put 10 grand a year per employee in a pot, we should be able to do our own medicine if we get the same prices as the hospitals, the insurance company. In other words, we should try and set that up. And every time
here's the thing, it shouldn't be 10 grand, it should be 2.
Okay, but whatever the number is. When I said 10, I meant half of what the 20 is now. Okay,
I'm just saying it's 5 times as expensive as it should be because of all the prices.
All right, let's start. What I'm saying is we should be like an experiment that the government watches, and there should be maybe 5 firms like us. And every time we run into a barrier to do this, like you're walking into Northwestern and go, my guy had an appendectomy, he charged me 50 grand, and yet Blue Cross Blue Shield's guy was 20 grand. I want my 30 back. Every time we run into a little barrier, a little wall, like forming an airline and finding out there's no landing slots left, even though there's been 15 gates, it's never a plane in them. Every time we run into a barrier, we should address it. And we knock off all these little barriers and get some competition back in the system. That's the only way I see it going. But I don't see anybody with the desire to do that, except maybe you and me.
Well, no, nobody wants to do it because what we've done by allowing this to go on for so long is we've now got $1.05 in the economy being spent on this.
Right.
And that also means that you got 1 in 5 employees. And the problem with that is not that they're doctors and nurses. Only 5 to 10% of them are doctors and nurses that actually treat people. The rest, their entire job is hosing you.
Well, we gotta let you go, Carl.
If you stop the hosing, they don't have a job.
We gotta let you go. We might kick on you next week because if you're not doing much holiday week, we probably need you because we got some people out. But hey, the thing you're forgetting is you're also paying 500 economists in the Fed and other places that are willing to tell you that that's only 6% of the economy in the CPI. So you got that going for you.
Yeah. Exactly.
Carl, take care of yourself. SP Futures now, down 175. Whoa. NASDAQ Futures down 4. We'll be right back. Mr. Helsner, Professor Helsner.
Hello, I'm David Andelman, founder and president of DAX Research, a registered commodity trading advisor. I'm also a wealth manager with PTI and a frequent contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio show. For more than 30 years, professional traders at the CME, including 4 past CME presidents, have chosen DAX Research to help guide their trading. That same research is available to you. We are offering 3 research newsletters: the Daily News, our Daily Stock and Futures Trading Recommendations, and our twice-weekly top 3 tiers of recommended stocks. Each of these reports are available via email. To benefit from the same research professionals have used for more than 3 decades, call me and get 2 weeks free with a 1-month subscription, or you may also call me for a free portfolio analysis to see how we can work together to build your future. I'm David Andelman, president of DAX Research. Call toll-free 1-800-821-4968. Stock and futures have risk of loss and are not suitable for everyone.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed-income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTIsecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTIsecurities.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of HomeSource Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Hi, this is John Neal from PTI Securities and Futures and a frequent contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, as well as the branch manager of our Peoria, Arizona location. I hope you, like many of our listeners, have benefited from the outstanding market returns of the last several years. But have you recently become unsettled due to the worldwide geopolitical uncertainty, the increased volatility of commodities and currencies, or the looming Federal Reserve interest rate hikes? If you have answered yes to any of these questions, we can help you. Here at PTI, we offer a unique variety of income-producing securities as well as our proprietary hedging program to protect your assets. More information about these exciting programs and much more can be obtained from our website at PTIsecurities.com, or feel free to email me at john@PTIsecurities.com. That's john@PTIsecurities.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here.
Something happening here. Hello. Welcome to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howley, Mr. Matt Weber. Professor, how are you?
Good morning.
S&P futures down 275, NASDAQ futures down $6, so nothing much happening here. We got stocks moving, Boeing up, $1.92. I'm going to say this thing. I'll get the exact number here. You been following this Boeing thing at all, Professor? Pretty interesting.
No, what?
The Boeing situation? With the
I haven't been following it. No, what's going on?
Well, they pulled the 737s out of production now. There's got to be tens of thousands of people working on that worldwide. I mean, good Lord! I mean, I don't know what
I haven't really looked into it too much, but I did hear I did see this headline on that though.
Well, they went from my numbers might be a hair off, but during this whole mess, they went from, I think, somewhere in the 50s production, but still were popping out 40 a month, even with them not being able to deliver them. And that's been, it's a year since the first one went down, but I'm saying since March, so it's got to be nine months. So we're talking 300 and some planes that they've essentially paid for all the parts and all the other stuff that they're now parked someplace. And the suppliers, I think, are still getting paid. Well, now I don't know if they're going to get paid. And I don't know if those guys can shut their lines down. I mean, I can't even imagine. How many parts do you think are on a plane? A million?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was in the Navy, helicopter, every 100 hours, I believe, had to be, that was on our flight deck, it had to be torn down and rebuilt, all the parts down to nothing, and then rebuilt every 100 hours or so of flight.
Why?
So it's got a lot of parts, yeah.
You drove me to a Pullman story. One of my, the engineers at Pullman, a guy named Marty Leno, was the smartest man I ever met, was a mechanical engineer, and he worked on helicopters at Boeing. And he, for a long time, he was doing studies in the Pentagon. They make you go in there, Hal and Maddie, and they give you a private room to do your work during the day. You can't take a briefcase in or a briefcase out. Everything you do has to stay in that room, and then you give them the report, and you leave. You can't even take your report with you. But the helicopters that went down in the raid, the Jimmy Carter raid in Iran, those were helicopters that after the what do you call the thing that spins, the rotor? The rotors were so screwed up that they ended up making titanium rotors, which cost a fortune. Like you're saying, every 300 hours they had to replace them, and they were like a couple hundred grand a piece back then.
Yeah.
I mean, it was...
Well, weren't those helicopters kind of flying low? And
yeah, but they knew... Yeah. It's amazing that some general had basically his ass on this program. And no matter what, no matter how many they were, they weren't Boeing, they weren't Sikorsky's, there was some other brand. Everybody knew they were horrible. He goes, why they picked them for that raid when they knew they were the least reliable they had in the fleet, he goes, I have no idea. I mean, he goes... You know, the history might have been different if they'd used a different make a helicopter. They might have got there.
When you're spending somebody else's money, like government does,
yeah,
you don't often make very good decisions, right?
No, it's it's pretty much interesting. And we've been doing economic stuff all week, and I want to do more about what you're teaching your guys. By the way, I found a history of the stock market during the Weimar Republic. Believe it or not.
Oh wow.
The thing went straight up.
You know, I might have to get a copy of that because this semester, in addition to teaching the most classes I've ever taught in my life before, I created this new course called Hitchhiker's Guide to the Catalaxy. And the Catalaxy is just another name for economy, so it's a nice play on words. But it's going to we're going to sprinkle through history. We're going to go through history. Not complex or comprehensive view of history, but just go look at some events in history like price setting in 18th century BC Babylon to hyperinflation in Sichuan, China. So we're gonna explore these little histories through time and then apply basic macro and microeconomics to it. So it'd be really cool to get a copy of that book that you just mentioned.
Well, there's a book in there they reference. The book is something like the Death of Money or whatever. So that's probably where they're getting all their info. But it's a business insider. We'll ship it to you.
Okay, nice. Yeah.
Did you catch this report here from Harvard Business School where they came out a couple of the economists? One of the guys' name is Michael something about how we managed to totally squander the longest recovery ever. No infrastructure stuff, no spare money to spend. We managed to basically piss it all away.
It didn't surprise me at all.
Well, we didn't used to do that.
You know, I was going to say that, right?
Yeah, but why have we changed so much that in the midst? I mean, politics is always. And if you look at the Roosevelt politics and the stuff before that, if possible, it was more bare knuckle than it is now. And yet, somewhere along the line, people would actually do stuff every now and then. It made sense.
Well, you know, I can't explain it. I don't know what's going on, but the deficit is what, $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion
yeah,
per year? The Republicans, when Obama was doing trillion-dollar deficits, were howling and yelling and screaming about the deficits and the debt. And they're quiet, I mean, really quiet, eerily quiet, when they're doing $1 trillion deficits. So, to me, it's just politics, and both parties are big government parties, and, you know, the Republicans, they have rhetoric that sounds like free market capitalism, but to me, they're just two big government parties. One's in for welfare, one's in for warfare, and that's why I think they've squandered this recovery. You know,
honey, when you ask your students, when you come in and go, students, lately I've been having some, you know, I run into a lot of
Tom, at Westminster, we don't say students. We say, hey, John, Martin, Madison.
Really?
We use first names. Because we have, you know, only about 20 people in each one of our classes.
Oh, so you're supposed to know who the hell they are. All right. Okay, well, that's fair enough. But
if you use students, you must be at a state university with, you know, amphitheater classrooms, right, filled with 400 people.
Well, the guy who did that was this guy, this accounting tax professor named Dinkolo, known as the Dink. Nice guy, big, huge guy. He was a football player. I don't know if he played at Notre Dame or where he played, but he was an offensive guard. You could tell by looking at him.
He probably had no neck, right?
Yeah, this massive, like a 20-inch short neck kind of thing. you know exactly what I'm talking about. And,
but
he would come in, students. he didn't care about anybody's name. he wasn't about to learn. You were just another accounting student as far as he was concerned. But I guess kind of where I'm seemingly like, we've had some discussions, you know, maybe over an adult beverage, maybe over coffee, maybe in the library, maybe not in the library, where people will say, you know, this is all capitalism versus socialism. I can't go, it's a socialism. And I go, first of all, I'm not pushing socialism either, but explain to me what you think we have now. And they'll go, what do you mean? I said, well, do you think this is capitalism? You think this is competitive? I mean, name me 10. Actually, we had some listeners. I was having trouble finding 10 businesses that I actually thought were competitive. And then we had a bunch of guys write in, and they go, they're right. Like dry cleaning, like barbers, a lot of your individual service industries, be it bars, bartenders and so on, are still competitive in agriculture. Once you get past that, and I'm going to say oil to a certain extent, to a large extent, is still competitive, certainly at the exploration level, not so much at the gas station level in Chicago. There's only like 3 firms. But I mean, before you define where you're headed, you almost got to define what you have. And it seems to me that most of the money now is spent in industries where there's 3 or 4 companies with their nose firmly up the ass of government. That's not competitive.
Yeah. So, well, I think it's more mercantilist. I had my students in macro read this article that was written, published in the Federal Reserve Bulletin, I think back in 1982. And the guy was talking about mercantilism in Europe, and he rattles off like 8 policies, and each one of those policies is why we have less competition than we would otherwise. So I think it's more mercantilist.
What are some of the 8? Just fill us in.
Well, just like, you know, regulations and anti-competitive regulations, taxation, tariffs, quotas. It was just like 8 of them, and every one of those are present in our system today.
And growing.
Yeah.
And there isn't a merger we don't like.
Yeah. Well, the Antitrust Sherman Act is really an act where a competitor will kind of launch an investigation. And it comes from the competitors, and they want to put out of business the bigger competitor. And so to me, the Anti-Sherman Act is 1984 newspeak for creating monopoly power instead of tearing it down.
Sherman Act, I'm going to push back on that one. I'm not a lawyer, but as I recall, the Sherman Act says any combination resulting in restraint of trade is a felony. How does it get more plain than that?
Well, I think it's just where it's applied. Been used to help other firms knock down the big boy, and so to me, it seems more like a vehicle that permits. I mean, come on, we have monopoly power everywhere, don't we?
I'm saying it's
Anti-Sherman Trust Act.
It's totally been ignored. That's my concern. I mean, even Lou Michaels comes out. He says I don't know how he, Manny, what did he say? Since you have so many regulations in the healthcare industry, the regulations supersede the Sherman Act. I'm going, wait a minute, how the hell does that happen? He goes,
I think anytime you add a regulation, you rarely take one away. And so you got all the, I mean, if you look at just the number of pages in the Federal Registry, it's growing geometrically, and so every time you add regulation, you leave regulation on the books. There's got to be conflict, right? So
well, the X says, you know, very simply,
you could be complying with regulation, new regulation, but maybe you're violating old regulation, right?
Well, I mean, to me, the act is very simple, and it says if Elsner buys in a small town in Utah, buys Matt Weber's hot dog stand and runs up the price of hot dogs, it's a felony. It's simple.
Well, I don't think that's the way it's being used.
Well, no doubt. That's my point. I mean, use it all.
The language is written, I mean, whenever D.C. writes legislation, it's always written in a way to better sell it, but it's just how it's been applied. So I rarely look at what is said. I look at what has happened.
Well, yeah, the answer is nothing.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I mean, Ronald Reagan for 8 years, my question to you is, when you have a Justice Department where the antitrust division doesn't do anything for 8 years, what do they do all day? Do they come to work? Do they play golf in the afternoon? Do they at least leave early, or do they sit there and do God knows what?
Well, you know, maybe that's the reason why the VA was under all kinds of pressure. They passed a law, a federal government law, where the unproductive workers can be fired at the VA. I think what they need to do is they need to apply that to all branches of government, right? All
well,
branches of
yeah.
the administrative branch of government.
I can get rid of some regulators in my area, I know. Just
yeah.
saying.
There's probably a lot of people that work for the federal government that I would suspect probably do very little, like you were just mentioning at the, you know, with respect to the Reagan administration.
So, yeah, I'm saying,
you know, it's probably a pretty common night.
Which one thing, I mean, do they process cases that they would normally have have pursued and just don't pursue them?
Well, I worked in the Navy, and, you know, we worked a lot of hours, but when you really look at what we did while we were on watch, we didn't really do that much, right?
Well, you watched.
It seemed like we were always, you know, one reason I don't like painting right now is because in the Navy, when I was on watch, I painted my area that I was in charge of, painting lagging on pipes, painting turbines, painting this, painting that. And so I did a lot of painting on a nuclear power plant because I'm on watch 15 hours a day, you know, 3 5-hour watches a day. There wasn't much else to do, you know.
Well, if you watched and nothing bad happened, you were successful.
Well, yeah, but when you're underway on an old nuclear power powered cruiser and you're doing the same turns in the ocean, there's not much to do. I mean, you could probably take your logs from the seawater inlet temperature, you know. You're not changing. You're not changing speeds. You're just kind of doing 15 knots.
So you were on a nuclear powered cruiser. I didn't know we had those.
Well, we had them back when I was in the Navy. They don't have them anymore. We had nuclear powered submarines, carriers, and then these little cruisers.
Because they had
the little cruisers, man. Those were steaming pigs because the fuel is paid for. They have fuel for 14, 15 years, and we were underway all the time. We were never in our home port because our fuel is paid for. Already, it was sunk.
All right. So, what are you doing when you try to take it apart? What do you do with all that stuff?
Well, we're not really taking it apart. We're just trying to keep it together.
No. You say they don't have them anymore. When you retire one of those ships, then what do you do?
There's a big graveyard there in Bremerton. At least when I was in the Navy, there's a bunch of ships that were pierside in Bremerton that were kind of basically holed out. All you could see was their holes. But some of them become like floating museums. I think
well,
we
I'm
had
saying,
the,
what do you, what are you doing?
We had a World War II battleship in Bremerton that was really cool.
Oh yeah, the one they just moved it. They moved to Hawaii. It was in Missouri, right?
Yeah, I think that was in one of those Iowa-class.
Yeah, it was. That's the one they
destroyers. They were in Bremerton, and you could actually go on the ship and,
well, I've been
and
to,
check it out.
If you ever go to Philadelphia, go across the river, and it's a battleship New Jersey's there. You can do. It was one of the most fascinating things I ever did. Took a tour of the battleship.
Oh, it's so cool. I like the hardwood floors.
Oh yeah,
the decking.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Well, they thought that
you guys had to take care of that. Holy smokes!
Oh yeah. Well, you know, like the Clayton Act. I mean, Clayton Act gets more specific. It basically says that you can't without justification have two-tiered pricing systems.
Yeah.
And yet, how many tiers does a college have? How many tiers does a hospital have? The law
says
you can't do it. Everybody does it. It's like, okay, we'll just do it. See if somebody comes after us. The answer is they don't.
Yeah, firms give discounts all the time, so, you know, the tiered pricing system.
No, you can give quantity discounts that are, like, justified. What you can't do, according to the law, is if if you go to Northwestern with an appendectomy, it can't be $100,000 for you and $20,000 for Blue Cross Blue Shield, essentially forcing you to buy insurance. Yet that's exactly what does happen.
Well, right? Exactly. I was reading this article, and one of my colleagues shared an article with me about how this hospital lists its one of its surgeries at 10 times what another hospital does. And my colleague was, you know, kind of outraged, and I looked at it like, well, maybe this particular hospital thinks its surgery is the BMW of these types of surgeries and just charges more.
Oh, they're going to get it's like college tuition.
Yeah.
Which to me, I mean, nobody. See, the problem is, if somebody put me in a position of power, I'd bring guys like you and Carl and Kevin along with me. I'd even bring Manny Weber, and we would be the bull in the china shop. I would absolutely separate a college aide from the college. The idea of going to Notre Dame and say, well, what's the tuition? And then the next question is, how much you got? What does that got to do with anything? I'm going to go buy.
A lot of schools engage in perfect price discrimination where if your kid gets in, you can kind of negotiate the tuition that you're willing to pay.
Well, or can or whatever. Yeah. But I mean, the idea of, you know, if I stop at S&T Provisions and buy Italian sausage like I do once in a while, I don't walk in and they go, oh, you're from the north side, it's $5 a pound for you instead of $3.50. I mean, we do it in hospitals, we do it in medicine, we do it in colleges all over the place. I mean, there's a certain simplicity to my economics, and I'm going to ask you if it's yours, to just say, how much is a Notre Dame tuition? It's $35,000. That's the answer. It's $40,000. It's $50,000. It's not, well, it depends. Depends on what? What's the number? I mean, if the number is 60 and I can't afford it, it's up to me to get the loan to bring back the check for 60. It's not up to you to say, you'll get me the loan or you'll do this or you do that or you'll have a separate place where people give you money that they can take as a tax deduction where they're buying indulgences or something, you know, and we're going to steal charity money from people. We're going to put a bunch of people in charge that are making $1 billion. And oh, by the way, we'll tap them for 25 and we'll move it over to this shell. That to me is insanity. Now the college,
well,
should,
you know,
it should be.
I think
it's 40
I think
grand.
It has something to do with the fact that the people that can are willing and able to pay that tuition, they're pretty much probably mostly, I would suspect, without loans, rich people.
Yeah,
and I think if you had just rich kids on the campus, the diversity of thought would be pretty limited. So I can see why a school would want to charge rich people up to their demand curve, right, the $60,000 per year, and then maybe negotiate with people from other backgrounds just to stir it up a little bit.
I understand the routine, but if you apply that to any other normal economic business, it sounds so ridiculous that people would laugh at you.
Well, I understand that, but I think with college, it's more than just. It's kind of a social experience, right? Where some schools with awesome football programs or awesome basketball programs, kids want that and they're willing to pay to go to that school because they want to be part of a winner, right? So it's got a lot of other
cultural
aspects to it.
I understand where you use the term the BS they blow by you to make it happen. I get it, right? You know, I get
that.
Hey, part.
Tom, my wife gave me a coffee cup that says PhD. Taking your BS to a new level.
but just imagine for a second going into the a food store and you walk up and the hamburger says $3.50 and they go, you look to me like you're a professor, not a student. It's $5 for you. I mean, you'd be the most outraged man on earth.
Yeah, I suspect I would. But I'd just go somewhere else, right?
Well, I got this.
Wait, let's get my coffee.
Well, I got this odd discussion with Audrey, my significant other, one of her best friends from Color Guard and stuff. They moved to Rockford, and the guy this is 20 years ago, and this is before any Obamacare and this stuff. And the guy's, I said, well, how do you charge people? He goes, well, that's interesting. This is back when you had like the really high end insurance policies. It was just starting to be this negotiated stuff. So this might have been in the 90s. And he goes, well, it depends. I go, what do you mean? My ears perk up. What do you mean it depends? As well, if you walk in and you've got, you know, Aetna or somebody and they pay full bore and you have a baby, it's $20,000, and we pack you up with the diapers at $2 a diaper going out the door. And the, if you need, all, it's it, your number is here. Now, if you're with somebody who's negotiated a rate, it's down a little bit. He goes, if it's Medicaid, we're going to get $80 a day, whether we do brain surgery, delivery of baby, or what we do. So then there's those people. Then there's some that, that don't pay at all. Then there's the Medicare people. So we got like five or six different prices. And I immediately thought, well, that's not sustainable. I mean, somewhere along the line, the people up top are going to get my 20. I mean, every hospital was charged with sort of insuring and maneuver this around themselves to make it all work. And I'm sick of that. That's not sustainable. I mean,
well, think about this. If we all had one choice, a Medicare-type program, think about how horrible the quality would be, right? That's something to think about.
But you'd end up
they're only going to pay that minimum, right?
Somehow or another, we were just talking to Carl about it. We've got to get some competition back in the system, and we have to make it worthwhile for somebody who has insurance to, instead of just going to, if he's got an MRI on his wrist, instead of going to Northwestern for $6,000 to look at, to hear the ad, call up Cleveland Clinic, and go to the same place at two in the morning and pay $600. We have to incent somebody to do that, and right now we don't.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, when I got my job at North Carolina, ANC State University, right out of my PhD program, I'm sitting in benefits orientation, and I raised my hand and I asked a question. Is it possible to get a $5,000 pay raise instead of having to deflect all this insurance? I didn't want insurance. I just wanted to be paid more because I was going to put that extra money into an account and save it. And then maybe when I got married and had kids, then I would choose insurance. But no, they said I had to have insurance. I'm like, all right.
Well, the issue is, we're just talking about this with Carl, that if PTI had 500 employees, which, God, I never really want, but if we did, the economics of it are we should have our own prescription benefit program. We should have our own, and we should only insure in case somebody has a baby that's born after 6 months or whatever. That could be $1 million. I mean, there's stuff but the problem, Hal, is if we go to the hospital, our prices are going to be triple Blue Cross. That's the issue. Otherwise, we should be able to pay the bill ourselves.
Well, let me ask you this question. Why is it like that? I mean, if you ask the question, who benefits, quo bono?
The insurance company.
Perhaps it's anti-competitive because it puts the small mom-and-pop businesses, it puts them at a massive disadvantage and creates this environment of monopoly power.
You cannot self-insure, not because of the money. You can't self-insure because of the pricing system.
What I'm saying is, why would this policy be put in place to keep small firms like PTI Investments small, right?
Well, it keeps the...
It puts you at a competitive disadvantage.
The insurance companies have a carve-out. They actually have a law that my guys from the Fed showed to me, and there's a name for it. If they were here, they'd rattle it off. If Lou was here, he'd rattle it off. There's a law that says if you're a smoker and you're this, that, and the other thing, they can actually charge you a little bit more for life insurance than they charge me. Okay? And they have a carve-out of the Clayton Act for that. They've taken that the next step and said they get to negotiate with hospitals. So if you walk into a hospital and say, geez, it looks like I got a stomach pain, how much is an appendectomy? They'll say $50,000. Well, how much is it Blue Cross? It's $20,000. They do that. They've taken it to the next level. Hell, we got a dash, but let's not be so long next time. Who knows? We might call you next week. We might have you on for a Christmas week or a year-end week.
Sounds
or whatever.
Good to me.
All right, buddy, take care. SP Futures down 2.25. NASDAQ Futures down 5. Come back, Mr. David Adelman.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox. at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howard, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. At PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howley, Mr. Matt Weber, Mr. David Handelman in a second. S&P Futures now down 3, and NASDAQ Futures down 575. And David gets here, he's going to tell me which is top step now, March or December. I'm sure he's going to say March, and I've been giving you to December. Dow Futures up 2, that's mostly because of Boeing, of 265, which is a reasonable chunk off its low. I think it got down to 318 maybe or something. So it's bounced back some, not exactly sure why, because they're stopping the production is 737, but then again, I guess Monopoly has its privileges, Manny. DAX down 74 points, 0.6%. FTSE up 4. Call that flat. CAC around down 15.2%, so a little lower than earlier, but still not much of anything. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei down 69.3%. Shanghai up 2 cents. Let's call that one flat, but hovering over 3,000, which it has been for a while, 3,017. Hang Seng down 83.3%. 27.8 is the whole number there. Bonds, again, we get right there. Japan 10-year minus 0.01. 10-year of our 10-year, 1.93 with a big move up yesterday. Bund minus 2.1, which is, I'm going to say, maybe one of those guys, maybe by the end of the year, is going to break to the plus side. We will see. I don't know if it's because of Christine Lagarde or where the people are saying, no, I'm not giving you my money for 10 years for nothing. Oil down a dime, 60.83. Brent down 7 cents, 66.10. Natural gas, 224, minus 4 cents. And we're going to get David's read on whether he thinks by summer it'll be below $2. RBOB, 168. And last but not least, gold down 70 cents, but hanging in there at 1478. Silver down 3 cents, 17.01. Matty, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. The Bulls finally played a little defense for 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's all it takes sometimes. 36 minutes past the hour. Good morning once again to everyone out there. Traffic building, especially on the inbound Stevenson due to a couple of crashes. We have one out in the southwest suburbs near Bolingbrook, I-55 on the northbound side before Route 53. That's blocking the two left lanes and causing significant congestion as you're heading northbound on I-55. And then further inbound, right near the Dan Ryan, there's a crash on I-55 northbound as you get near that Dan Ryan merger there. So I-55 is our slowest moving expressway, the Stevenson, this morning, so keep that in mind. No issues on the Ryan itself. Bishop Ford and I-57 look relatively quiet. Eisenhower traffic is building, but no accidents to report. Traffic building steadily on the Edens and Kennedy, too, but no accidents there either. In the western suburbs, Route 53 at I-355, the Veterans Memorial, there is a crash. And then just west of there in Wheaton, it looks like there is a crash. County Farm Road there in Wheaton is the only other crash on the screen. Everything else looking good out there. Weather today, sunshine, cold temperatures early, and high winds. Right now it is 20 with a wind chill of 7 above zero, but we're going up to a relatively mild high of 39 with some sunshine this afternoon. So enjoy a nice afternoon after a few cold days in a row. For our Phoenix listeners, sunshine with a high of 64 today. Right now it's partly cloudy and 40. In sports, as Chief mentioned, the Bulls rallied back from 18 down in the fourth to force overtime and beat the Wizards 110-109. Blackhawks lost again. They've dropped 5 out of 6 and 11 of their last 15 as they fell at home to the Avalanche 4-1. Busy night in college basketball. DePaul is 11-1. They beat Cleveland State 73-65. Loyola with a nice win down at Vanderbilt 78-70. Northwestern lost a tough home game to Michigan State, who's ranked 15th, 77-72. And for our Arizona listeners, Arizona State was blown out by St. Mary's 96-56.
Chief. Do you believe that the Irish... Hey, David, how are you?
I'm fine.
Do you believe that the Irish now only have 8 people on their basketball team?
Well, I know that's not true.
It is true.
You're saying they have 8 healthy players right now? Or
they have...
They probably have about 12 or 13 guys on their team.
They have one guy who left, one guy who's hurt, and they have 2 scholarship spots being taken up by people that have to sit out this year because they transferred in. They have no freshmen.
Interesting. So they have 8 guys that are healthy
probably,
and taking the floor
think,
right
I
now.
Think they got a couple of walk-ons at the end of the bench filling up the chairs, but they have like 8 scholarship guys ready to go.
Yeah, that's kind of all you need, but you're one injury away from being in trouble there.
You got some eligibility left? We'll get you back in grad school.
I don't think I'm smart enough to go to Notre Dame. I certainly don't have the money.
We'll have to get you one of those scholarships.
Notre Dame now, when you guys went, it was what, like $2,000? Now it's about 65?
Don't make it earlier than it was. It was $3,000.
Oh, $3,000. Well, now it's about 65.
If you put the $3,000 in the CPI indicator, it should be like 17.8 now, and it's like 60.
Yeah.
The interesting part is the room and board was $1,000, which was pretty much standard. I mean, Western Illinois was $1,000. Everybody was $1,000, even the state schools. And everybody got mystery meat or chicken every night, but which was fine. I mean, it wasn't bad. And then now it's got to be some places are like 16. Well, how does it take you 16 to put somebody in a dorm room and feed them
bread and potatoes every day?
Yeah, I mean, what are you doing with $16,000? Are they getting massages with happy endings every night? What are you getting?
This is a family show.
Yeah, what are we doing? I mean, I know downtown here. I mean, there's dorm rooms that are on State Street, so I get that. But I mean, well, how does the same crummy room in the plains of Indiana go from $1,000 to 16? I mean, it's still a cinder block army cot. You go down the hall to the bathroom. I mean, what are we talking? Northwestern is like 17. I mean, I don't know. Are there dorms that nice?
They can't be.
That's right. They can't be.
By the way, Notre Dame in their win against UCLA only played 7 guys.
Yeah, yeah.
But like I said, sometimes, I follow the Iowa basketball team pretty closely, but I follow college basketball in general pretty closely, and I found that when teams kind of have too many of the same player and they try to play everybody and they'll play 10 or 11 guys, they kind of, it's like they can never get into a rhythm and they really struggle. The teams that really have a defined group of a starting five and maybe one or two or three guys off the bench that they trust and they only play those guys, they seem to play a lot better to me. I mean, I know you want depth, but you almost don't need it. You're almost better off playing guys a little bit more minutes and getting into a rhythm.
Put it another way, with the, you're talking about 20 minute halves, okay? And I'm going to say,
with built-in TV timeouts every 4 minutes,
I'm going to say that there's at least 15 stoppages of play per half, maybe 12. So the idea that you can't play the whole half physically, but you are talking about sometimes the Zebras get a little overzealous if the game's rough. I mean, you know, you can't have
foul trouble. Definitely factors in.
Yeah, but when you pile into an ACC schedule, 8 guys is rough.
I don't think, I mean, you want to have the option to have 9 or 10 that you trust, so you're not playing walk-ons, like you said.
Right.
But you really don't, I mean, even in my rec basketball league, we have 10 guys on our roster, but we did that because guys travel for work, guys, you know, have things come and go on the schedule, and it's very rarely, in fact, we've never once had all 10 guys show up. Someone's hurt, or someone's out traveling, or someone's sick, or someone's got something going on, and many nights we have 6 or 7 guys. And we always play much better when we have 6 or 7 guys versus when we have 9 guys.
Well, there's no question, Manny, that if, I mean, obviously a softball game, if nobody is going to get hurt and there's going to be no problem, as a coach, I'd love to have the 10 right people show up. then I don't know if they're anything about everybody, anything. Or 11, we could bat an extra guy. I don't want 15 there. I'm worried about this guy coming in, this guy bitching.
Yeah, I mean, it's true.
But the fact is, you'd like to have the big freshman on the bench. Where, okay, your other guy's got 3 fouls and they got a couple of big guys on the other team, you're going to play the guy 6 minutes.
And it's good for his development.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm just saying it's a little light going in. I mean, look at me, you know, when I mentioned earlier that in the summer they managed to fill some of the stuff up. Stanford only had, you know, 58, 60 guys on scholarship and Alabama's got 85 plus, plus, plus. And you're going with, you know, a 12 game schedule and you know that 15, 20 guys on each team.
Football's a lot different, by the way.
Well,
guys get hurt every week.
But guys get hurt in basketball,
too. Not the same. I mean, you'll have guys banged up. Very rarely do you have, in men's basketball, the season-ending injury. I mean, you have it. Maybe one guy.
Well, they had Pfluger last year in ACL.
Yeah, you very rarely will have 4 guys have that. Football, everyone gets hurt. Everyone misses games.
What I'm saying is there should be a blend. There should be the 8 plus the 2 talented freshmen that if you get them a few minutes in the you can count on for a little bit in a big game, and oh, by the way, in a crummy game, they're going to get their 8 minutes of development time.
You don't want
those 2 seats. You don't want no freshmen at the end of the bench.
Completely agree with that. I'm just saying you don't need more than 8 in your rotation.
Oh, any given night.
Yeah,
you want to have
10, of course.
Anyway, David, market, I don't know. We got a few days left in here. By the way, what's top step now, December or March?
March.
All right, so I should stop talking about the Decembers. All right, I will do that. What are you thinking here? I think with the Fed doing what they're doing, we're going to continue to leak up to the end of the year. But I also starting to look a little tired. So I don't know what I'm thinking here.
No, that's what the technicals reflect. Although they've reflected that, you know, for a while now, you have extension. I wouldn't say it's huge, but pretty good extension in the price momentum oscillators. There's also divergences. When I say that, it's the underlying oscillators are not making a new high along with the underlying, you know, whether it's cash indexes or futures. So you have that. And there's Standard & Poor's, S&P, publishes an oscillator that ranges from, I think, -8 to +8. And anything over +4 is extended. It hit +5 yesterday. Now, it doesn't mean it can't go to +8, but that would be very extreme. Typically, 5, which is it just reached yesterday or higher, has at least 3 days or 4 days of setbacks just to, you know, clean it up, get some of that extension out. That said, Christmas is next week, and the day before a holiday close, to 3 days after, you know, which we find next week, is very positive. And Christmas to New Year's is one of the most reliable indicators other than July 4th, which is the most compliant with historicals. So, you know, my thought would be, whether it's today, tomorrow, Monday, Tuesday, of next week, we ought to have a mild setback, and it'll probably be met with buying.
So we're not going to have a minus 500-point Christmas Eve or the hell we had last year.
It could, but I doubt it. Yeah. I sincerely doubt it. These breaks are very well supported. Oh, and your comment on Boeing, you know, why would it hold? If you remember Monday, I said anything near 320 should be bought for a play, and it went to 320.61 and has rallied, you know, with the pre-opening about $13-14. Why? You know, the markets are relatively thin. It's holiday markets, and, you know, the low last summer was 319.55, so you got within $1, $1.05. And at that point, somebody can say, hey, regardless of the bad news, a lot of it's probably discounted. I can risk $2-3 here. And if I'm right, it at least goes back to 355, maybe even 375. And I'm not calling for that, nor do I own a share, but it's a technical play that makes sense.
I cannot believe, you know, first of all, I'm going to say that you are correct, that it probably is discounted. And I'm going to say that how the bleep could it possibly be discounted? $1 billion a month, no end in sight, not to mention getting these things back together and paying off all these airlines for the... How could even as big as Boeing is, the monopoly does have its privileges, how could this not be a big, big blip on the radar screen when all is said and done? Or are they...
Well, that's probably what it is. A reaction back to 355 where you run into moving averages or, you know, old peaks at 370, 375, that probably is a quote-unquote blip. The one thing I would disagree with your statement is no end in sight. There is an end in sight. I don't know when that end is. I don't know if it's January or February where the 737 MAX is probably approved, and maybe April, May, you know, it's back in the skies. But the other thing, and I mentioned this when, you know, I talked about the 320, you know, just whatever, correction, short covering rally, whatever you want to call it, is that when you totally shut off production, when you got big inventory and you tell your parts suppliers, hey, we're not buying any more because, you know, we can't put it in the sky, and we're gonna whatever it is, layoff, furlough, move workers, whatever term you want to use, that is, you know, rather it cuts down the bleeding temporarily. Yes, you have obligations to Southwest, to United, whatever that's, you know, that are on the screen going forward, but that's then and this is now.
I just, a lot of things you look at, David, and by the way, these are not something you'd ever trade on, because I wouldn't.
I don't have a share.
No, I'm saying, I look at this, my chart here, and in January of 2018, before any of this was a gleam in the designer's eye, okay, any of these problems, the stock was 290. Now here, after all this mess, all this stuff parking, we're hiring people right and left just to maintain stuff on the ground. Who the hell knows how long it's going to take a plane that was finished in May and has been parked for 7 months now to get it in the air safely after you do the retrofit, which whatever you have to. I mean, I don't know, is that a 4 month project, a 2 month project? Where, do you have to fly it back to Boeing? Does it have to go back in the assembly line? Can you do it where it is? Can somebody just walk in the front and change the software? None of that stuff. How can the company be worth 15% more now than it was then? If it isn't the some of the money's
duopoly, and they have the biggest share, and you got over 4,400, I believe is the number, planes on order. Very few have been canceled over the next, whatever, 20 years.
I'm saying is if the Fed wasn't doing what they're doing, making money less, I could see a spectacular company that has a really good, you know, monopoly like they have. If the shares held even, I'd be stunned. Yet, I mean, they're up. I mean, it's. I'm saying, I, you know, the world for Boeing had to look a lot better in January of 18 than it does now. Just saying.
No, I get it. And you know, you were trading. I can't pinpoint the exact number, but you were trading with a multiple of around 18 to 20. Now, presuming that, you know, they get some earnings and the like, you have a current PE on my screen of 50.7 and forward PE for next year of 402.
Well, yeah, and everybody's just waiting for this month that all of a sudden you're going to deliver you know, 50 of these plants. I don't know that you can, David.
No, I get it. You can't gear up. Even if they got the approval tomorrow, you can't gear up and get it, you know, going right away.
I mean, I'm stunned at the accounting firm. The last we heard was they're talking about $5 billion. Well, I'm going to say it's way more than $5 billion. And because they're so big, I mean, Pullman had to give these estimates every quarter. I mean, Boeing hasn't given one, have they?
No, I don't think so.
If you're big enough, none of this stuff applies to you. I love it, I guess. You know,
well, it should.
It should. But I mean,
and you know more about, you know, the fundamentals and the write-offs and the legal obligations, et cetera, than I do. But, you know, at least on the surface, I totally agree with you.
Well, they're a Chicago company now. I mean, I don't want, you know, Boeing sucking on this 2 years from now. I mean, obviously, everybody needs these planes. Everybody wants them to be proper. I think there's a shred of a chance that somehow or another the design is just bad. I hope that that's not the situation. They just overworked, you know, an old size and tried to make it too big and go too fast. Not too fast, doesn't go any faster. But I hope that the FAA isn't just finding more and more problems as they go.
There's been studies, and you know, I certainly don't have the wherewithal or research knowledge to know, but they say that, you know, had they not taken them out of the air, just whatever, design flaws, stress fractures, whatever you want to call it, that had they not taken them out of the air, there would have been 15 or 16 more crashes.
That would not have been good.
No,
I mean, I hope none of that's... But like I say, I've been involved in a program where there were parts that just weren't right. And
it seems like, again, from the studies that I've read, seems like that there were just, yeah, there were design flaws, software issues, lack of training to pilots. If this happens, do this, override the system that way. I mean, evidently, there was a lot. It wasn't just, oh, geez, two went bad and 50,000 flights went good. It was beyond that.
Well, it's all about, if you read the stuff, you know, of course, me not being, I got to go back to the bar at the Club Lago, where there's a couple of guys there that are pilots and are lawyers that are kind of involved in this, and they can explain it to me a lot better. But it seems to me, David, from what we first learned about this, is it was a system that was put on this plane to kind of help out with this, that, and the other thing. And the problem was that it was doing something and fighting the pilots. So at first blush, if that's all it was, you would think, you would just say, turn the friggin' thing off. Don't turn the automatic pilot on. Fly it up to 20,000 feet on yourself and then turn it on. I mean, you would think that if it was that simple, that would be the fix. And,
right.
And a year from now, if you actually wanted to put the system back in and say you actually do sort of need it or maybe want it, you could put, but the way it sounded to me is if these guys would have just turned it off, there wouldn't have been a problem. Yet the fix isn't just turn it off. It doesn't appear. Right?
I think you're correct.
The first blush was take the switch, tape it in the off position, and don't ever move it. But clearly that's something they're finding more as they go here, it appears.
Yep.
Anyway, so what, I had a listen to my man JD yesterday that I was piling on too much on this gold. When I saw this 10% money supply number, I was like a terrier after a bone wanting to put more on the gold. And it's moving a little bit. When is somebody going to wake up and say, whatever, with the money pouring in all over the world, you got to own gold? Or am I just too early as usual?
That's a great question. I mean, oscillators are positive. The movement, I mean, basis of February, top step, front month contract. I mean, you've been in a range between, whatever, 1455 and 1500, let's call it. You know, a couple of tops at 1500. I mean, over 1500, 1501 would definitely be a bottom and look to be about 1560. 1455, 1460 certainly looks like excellent support. I mean, right now it looks like a trading range with, because of the alignment of the moving average oscillators, I would say slight up bias, but really range bound. And yeah, and I tend not to be bullish gold, but I still believe that, you know, the real CPI and PPI figures are way understated, and, you know, don't include the real basket to consumers. And so I'd rather be a buyer than a seller. But since it's range-bound, you know, I would like to buy $20 breaks rather than buy in the middle of the range.
The other issue I want to hit you up on is if we had somebody that knew the different oil companies and who did what where, if Shanny's right, Tom Shanahan, that because the January natural gas is actually lowered into July, I don't know if it still is, he's absolutely convinced we're talking under $2 natural gas by July. Now, of course, we'll see if he's right for once in his life. But the point being, we've got oil creeping up. Now, if we had somebody that could tell us something, if we were to find an oil company that, let's say, was 60% more gaseous in the areas that they're exploring versus one that was 65 or 70% oil, is that a pairs trade? Should we go long one and short the other if we could figure out who the hell they were?
I don't have an answer to that. I do know that there was a commentary yesterday on CNBC that the short interest, even at these levels in natural gas, is the highest in the futures ever.
Well, that's probably the reason, because like he says, if January is low, because you have that much supply in the winter, come July, you're only going down.
Right.
Now, I don't know, under two, when was the last time we were under $2? That's been a long time.
Yeah.
You would think, boy, it's...
I can't imagine that, you know, at these levels that folks would want to pile into the short side. I mean, you know, say it goes to 190. Well, you know, that's fine and dandy, but, you know, if you're wrong at 205, you're looking at 260. So for 15 cents to the downside, you're risking 50, 60 cents to the upside. That would not be my idea of a good risk reward.
Well, we had that, was it late November last year? We're past that, obviously, where we had that really cold couple weeks in November. Didn't it spike to like 305?
Yeah. And I'm not saying that couldn't happen now, but...
It would have to take...
Yeah, it would. Yeah. You know, I'm sure we're swimming in it as far as supply, but we're discounting demand because, I mean, yeah, it's been cold, but, you know, you don't... Other than, you know, Minnesota and places like that, we haven't had the brutally cold winter that a lot of folks had forecasted. But just, you know, short covering when you have that kind of short interest outstanding, you know, whether it's futures or hedges or whatever.
Well, you know me, if I ever had the wherewithal to short it, I'd have to have a call in my back pocket just in case.
I think that'd be a smart thing.
Yeah, I mean,
when the whole crowd is on one side, and I don't mean whole, but when the vast majority of the folks, you know, are short, I don't think that's, and you're at low cyclical levels, I don't think that's a good time to be,
well,
you know, joining the crowd.
Well, you're saying if you're absolutely stone cold right, which how often does that happen, you're 30 cents to the good, and somehow we get an Arctic blast, and we spike to 290 or 60 cents or 80 cents to the bad. That's rough.
Yep.
What you know what? If we all of a sudden had a cold snap out of the blue, I think some people would be carried out at these numbers. Just saying. Especially.
No, I agree.
Maybe not if you're short to July, because that probably won't move very much, but the January would. But, I mean, I guess, don't you have to be, where I'm trying to get to here, is we've got oil creeping up, and we've had the XLE creeping up, but how much of the industry is oil versus natural gas? Is it, in other words, if we get a 20% up move in oil and a 10% down move in natural gas, are most companies, I guess, are to the good there, I'm thinking.
I don't know the answer to that.
Because, I know that the stuff in Pennsylvania, the stuff they were fracking there, was pretty gaseous. That everybody was having like a gas line in addition to the oil pipeline. But yeah, I don't know. Shanny says they're just flaring the stuff off in North Dakota. It's so cheap, it's not worth building anything, a pipeline, which is weird. But
well, that said, I mean, if you flare it off, doesn't that reduce supply?
Well, it's supply that nobody knew even had.
Right.
So yeah, it's so. End of the year prediction: are we up from here, or we just putter?
Given the seasonal day before close day, my prediction is we have a couple 3 days of sell off, and then probably finish the year strong. Maybe up a fraction from where we are, 1% net end of the year.
All right, bud. We'll talk at you next week.
Okay.
S&P futures down 3.25. As the futures down 5. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to PTISecurities.com. PTI ProDirect. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at PTIProDirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit Nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.